This is GeoTalks, a podcast by Blue Marble Geographics. Today's guest is Katrina Schweikert, a PhD student on a team at the University of Maine, led by computer scientist Dr. Torsten Hamann. The team is developing a tool to address and track the PFAS contamination affecting the United States. PFAS are a family of long-lasting chemicals defined by carbon-fluorine bonds that make them resistant to fire, water, and oil. The solution is the Safe Agricultural Products and Water Graph, often abbreviated to SAWGRAPH. In our conversation, she illustrates the scope of the SAWGRAPH and defines what sets it apart as a state-of-the-art tool for tracking PFAS.
Welcome to GeoTalks. I'm Cynthia Miranda.
And I'm Meg Scribner. Cynthia, I'm super excited to introduce our guest today, Katrina Schweikert. Katrina, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks. We finally had some warm weather hit us in the Northeast here.
Well, I hope that you enjoy the warmer weather. We're excited to hear about how your team is combating this problem. But first, welcome to GeoTalks.
Thank you.
I'm excited to discuss this amazing tool you've been working on, but I wanted to start by asking you to list all 14,000 of these chemicals from memory.
I'm not even sure I can pronounce them all.
But I wanted to start with that joke because it continues to surprise me how many of these chemicals there are, and it helps me understand the scope of the tool you're building a little bit better.
Yeah, I'm learning a lot as this project develops.
It is so great to have you join us today, Kat. It's good to hear your voice again. We've been hearing a lot about PFAS contamination in the United States over the past few months. And just recently, I read research from the USGS stating that almost half of the tap water in the United States is contaminated with PFAS. That figure sounded a little too alarming to me. Can you give our listeners a quick overview of PFAS and why it is so important to take action?
Absolutely. So as you've alluded to, PFAS are a family of chemicals. So it's about 14,000 in the current list. You know, there's different ways to kind of talk about PFAS chemicals. But basically, they are man-made chemicals that have a strong carbon-fluorine bond that connects them. And that makes them have really great properties that we like in our, you know, materials manufacturing, like being water resistant, water repellent, oil repellent, firefighting, et cetera. So they're used in, or they have historically been used in a lot of commercial products, things that you might, you know, have come to love, although a lot of them are reformulated now, things like Teflon and Gore-Tex and firefighting foam. Those are a lot of the really important things. You know, also a lot of like fabric protectants. And they're also used heavily in manufacturing to lubricate machines, especially in industries like pulp and paper and metal manufacturing. Unfortunately, not all of the health effects are fully understood, but what we do know is that especially some subsets of the chemicals can cause, you know, increased risk of cancer, things like testicular and kidney cancer, other complications in pregnant women like preeclampsia and high blood pressure, also small decreases in infant birth rate. Another scary one is a decreased vaccine response in children and changes to liver enzymes and cholesterol level. So there's a lot of research going on to understand the health effects of, you know, different kind of subfamilies of PFAS. And there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. But, you know, generally what we do know is because these are such persistent chemicals, they do bioaccumulate both in, you know, the animals that we might eat, in the soil and environment, and then ultimately in humans, which is you know, one of the biggest concerns.
Kat, would you be able to tell our listeners what it means to bioaccumulate?
Yeah, just that, you know, they're not breaking down in the human body and they're not necessarily eliminated through digestion. So, you know, they can end up in different parts of your body, like your liver and your kidneys.
Thanks for clarifying that. So Kat, you're on the research team working with Dr. Hamann at the University of Maine, and you're working on a tool that will allow users to more efficiently detect and measure the sites and sources of PFAS contamination throughout the U.S. This tool is called the Safe Agricultural Products and Water Graph, also known as SAWGRAPH. Would you tell us more about this project?
Absolutely. Thanks. So this project, we're building what's called the Geospatial Knowledge Graph, to integrate information about PFAS contamination, as the title indicates, in you know, agricultural products and water. So in the environment, in our drinking water, and kind of following it through potentially production chains, transportation chains, and trying to understand how this contamination is happening. So it's also aggregating a lot of the sampling data that's been going on across different states.
And Kat, what's your role in this project?
So my role is primarily, you know, working to build that knowledge graph. So we build what's called an ontology, which helps to understand, you know, the types of things that exist in our domain of study, and build some logic information that allows us to make inferences across that data. And then we integrate all the data into a big database that's actually a graph database. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little more detail. There's a lot of big words there, but that's kind of an overview of what we're doing.
Kat, that is so interesting and also very intense. Can you tell us about all the different types of data you work with in understanding PFAS contamination?
So there's a lot of ways that you can study PFAS. We're primarily focused on testing. So testing of food, water, animal tissue, soil, different materials that end up in our environment, like biosolids, and integrating that with what we know about potential sources of contamination. So, you know, especially facilities that we know to be emitting certain pollution into the environment. PFAS at this point by the EPA is not heavily regulated. So it's on a list of chemicals that's being studied in drinking water, but only a few of the chemicals are reported in some of the other, you know, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act systems right now. So there's some data there, but there certainly in the future might be more data. So we're kind of building a system that will be ready to look at more data. But so we're integrating, you know, what we know about chemical manufacturing and transport across different facilities, what we know about sample site, and then also vulnerability information. So, you know, where's the interface with humans? Where are maybe potentially certain communities that might be at higher risk?
Kat, I'm interested in how you incorporate this data into SolGraph. When we spoke in preparation for our conversation today, you mentioned that you use a desktop GIS to understand the data before integrating it. Could you tell us about that process?
Yeah, so there's a spatial component to most of this data. You know, we need to understand, for example, how a site that shows up as contaminated, where they've done some sampling, might relate to, you know, nearby water bodies or nearby aquifers, might relate to sources that we know are potentially, you know, putting out some pollution, or sites that we know that have contamination from something like a biosolid application. So yeah, ultimately I need to start in some kind of a desktop GIS to just visualize that before, you know, pulling it into our graph database. Global Mapper is really helpful for that, especially because our data comes in so many different formats. You know, we've got CSV, we've got JSON data, we've got all types of data from different web GIS and GeoServers, and then a lot of tabular information as well.
I love what you said about the data integration process because it gives me insight into what it takes to develop a project of this scale. Would you also be able to elaborate on the unique features that distinguish SolGraph as a state-of-the-art tool for tracking PFAS?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, we're building a geospatial knowledge graph. So that's a big word. What that really means is, you know, a graph database where we are connecting a lot of different type of data so that you can do queries and, you know, build visualizations to look at that data, maybe in a map or different types of charts and tables, you know, based on different information that you want to learn. So if you think about your standard GIS analysis, you know, you might bring all those layers together to just answer one question and do all that processing for one question. We're trying to build a system that will support a lot of different questions from a lot of different users. So in particular, you know, we're working with a lot of state agencies that are looking at, you know, understanding where they need to test for potential contamination. Also, you know, supporting, you know, potentially end users who are interested in finding out, you know, what risk might be around them, or, you know, other people with interest in certain communities and understanding, you know, what environmental justice issues might be occurring in their community. Also just the Environmental Protection Agency, who is, you know, actively studying these and trying to understand what regulation they might need to do in the future. And likewise, a lot of legislators, you know, that have a lot of questions about what is the risk here. So, you know, we're trying to build a system that will be able to answer a lot of those questions. And this is part of a larger NSF project that's called Proto-OKN. So it's a prototype of an open knowledge network. So there are teams working with a lot of other US government agencies to do this across different agencies. Not all of those are spatial graphs or spatial questions, But the idea of the open knowledge is that, you know, you integrate subsets of this data and you build that ontology on top of it, which kind of builds in some semantics and context around what the data is actually representing. And then that sets it up for, you know, potential reuse in the future so that you can, you know, pull data from. So, for example, right now we've been working on integrating, you know, state sampling that's happened in the state of Maine with the U.S. Water Quality Portal, which is, you know, integrating data from a lot of U.S. government agencies into one platform. And that's really the same type of data, but it doesn't necessarily follow the exact same schema or have quite the same format. So we need that data to talk to each other. So by building this interface, we're you know, kind of standardizing and allowing that data to talk to each other in the future as well. And so you can think about that across a lot of different things. And we can also pull out, you know, subsets of this graph. So for example, we are partnering with a team that's working on GeoConnects, which is taking a lot of that US hydrological data and building that into a structured graph. And we're looking at using that to trace things like, you know, upstream and downstream and understanding flow in the system, and also just integrate all the information about, you know, water bodies and rivers and streams and how that all integrates into our national, or at least continental US system of water. So yeah, it's an exciting project because it is, you know, adding that semantic layer on top of data. I think pretty much every data practitioner knows how hard it is to find data and then also kind of understand what's actually in the data that you're studying and make sense of, you know, column names that might be, you know, just short letters or initials that don't necessarily make sense. So the idea of this linked open data is to make that have greater information and context kind of inherent to the way that the data is stored.
Oh, interesting. So how will the structure of this linked open data make it easier for people to navigate?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways to kind of implement linked open data. Some of the things that a lot of GIS practitioners might have run into now are like JSON-LD formats. We're not so much working with that, but that is a way to kind of share data in a web service that has that extra semantic information associated with it. So you're starting to see that with you know, some of their popular, you know, U.S. government or other, you know, state agencies, et cetera, are starting to share their data that way. And that's what the GeoConnects project is really doing. So they're not necessarily storing all the water information. They're pulling that water information from different U.S. government agencies into one, you know, integrated structure. So far in the Sawgraph project, we are actually storing kind of copies of a lot of the data in a bigger database, you know, but we're building scripts that could allow us to update that on a regular basis and pull in new data as new data gets added. So there's kind of a few different models of how to do that. But we are, you know, understanding what the raw data looks like. And then as we ingest that, we're adding that context information so that we can say this property in this sample water set from the US government is, you know, equivalent to this property in our state testing database, et cetera. So information about chemicals, information about, you know, sampling methodology, information about, you know, different types of geographic features that we might care about that might be at risk, or also how that integrates to spatial information. So we're building in things like administrative boundaries, you know, potentially parcel data. We're also looking at integrating S2 cells, which is another way of sort of tiling spatial information so that we can kind of compare across our different data layers, you know, what might be at the same location.
This is such an exciting project with so many people working in conjunction to pull all this data and information together. When you are all said and done, when this project is complete, how will these tools be used? And will regular citizens like us have access to this tool, or will it be used only by government agencies and other research institutions?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't have a concrete answer at this point. There are some aspects of PFAS contamination information that, you know, potentially have some privacy considerations, you know, especially when you start looking at really detailed levels, like looking at private septic systems, you know, around a region, or, you know, certain testing that might happen at people's home water wells or things like that. So we're still kind of determining what information might be available in a public interface. And our kind of focus at this point is on those either, you know, government or other like research users that would, you know, potentially have some internal data that they might want represented in the system. So I think this is a 3-year project. As it develops, we'll have a better sense of what kind of PFAS interface might be available to the public. But certainly some subsets of this data are going to show up in projects. And hopefully, I think the goal of the NSF project at large is to find homes for some of this data that has that semantic information attached at different US government agencies.
All of this information is super interesting, and it's reassuring that all of the research that you mentioned, all of these different organizations and groups that are fitting into your project, it's obviously all of this data is vital for understanding the problem and how to tackle it. I am wondering, Kat, if you know of any other research efforts that are not part of your own project that is assessing the threat and helping us figure out a solution for this very real health issue that PFAS present us with.
Absolutely. So it's definitely one of those wicked problems where there's just a lot of things that we need to understand. And, you know, there's been a lot of, for example, survey papers that cover kind of the state of the field in different subdisciplines. But for example, you know, we're focused really on environmental contamination and kind of environmental pathways to that might, you know, in the future impact human health or, you know, affect human populations. There's a lot of other things that you can study about PFAS. For example, at the University of Maine and in the state of Maine in general, you know, a lot of focus has been on the biosolid application sites or the sludge spreading sites around the state. Some of those farms that were initially found to be contaminated a couple of years ago, and the university is doing a lot of testing there. And, you know, I know some of the other master's and PhD students that are actively looking at different plant uptake. So particularly they're studying how, you know, different plants might pull in different PFAS in different parts of the plants. I guess the question is really what could you potentially plant on a field that has been contaminated? Because not every plant takes up that those PFAS chemicals in the same way. And not every PFAS chemical has the same kind of plant pathway as well. And they're also looking at combinations of plants. So maybe planting you know, corn mixed with beans or something, or mixed with vegetables, is that changing the uptake in plants? And there's still a lot to be understood in terms of, you know, what plants might take it up into the part that humans are actually consuming or other animals are actually consuming as feed versus just taking it up into like the leaves or something that we're not necessarily consuming. There's a ton to be studied in the health aspect as well. So that's a huge field. At this point, we've sort of left that out of our project because, you know, as anybody who's kind of started to look into medical information and publishing in the medical world, there's just so much stuff going on all the time about that. So there's a lot of tests, a lot of CDCs around different states and other, you know, research groups as well that are looking at that information and doing different studies on that. You know, that's one of those tricky things where you can do some testing in animals, but, you know, with humans, you're kind of always doing these longitudinal studies across time. You can't really, you know, treat humans with PFAS contamination and see what happens, obviously. So it is tricky to kind of get information, especially in humans, about some of that contamination. We are integrating with the EPA CompTox tool. And one of the things that that tool does, that's a kind of a registry of all the different chemicals, and it links with a lot of other international registries of that information. And so that also links to a lot of the medical information. So that has, for example, you can kind of look up what studies have been done on certain chemicals and what, you know, health effects and health impacts we do already know from different studies. There's also a lot of efforts in different states. I think Michigan is doing a lot of studying right now to kind of understand, you know, different application factors. We've also talked to New Hampshire. In Maine so far, a lot of the contamination has been, or a lot of what we've tested at least has been focused on biosolid application, but there's certainly other places around the country and especially states that have a little bit more industrial production that have PFAS that are traveling, you know, out in smokestacks. So that's a whole different environmental contamination pathway that hopefully we will integrate some of that into our graph as well. But so far we've focused mostly on water and soil pathways.
It's so reassuring to know that there are so many people focused on trying to figure out this issue and come up with a solution for us. Thank you for joining us today and enlightening us about PFAS and your amazing work at this Sawgraph project. I hope we can invite you back as you progress in your research so you can tell us more about what you're learning. For now, where can our listeners find more information about the work that you and your research team are doing?
Yeah, so we have a website that covers kind of a brief overview, sawgraph.github.io, and that soon we'll have some contact information if you want to get in touch with us, find out more about the project, or, you know, potentially think you might be a good user of this tool, especially if you're doing research related to this.
We want to thank Katrina for joining us on the podcast today and for teaching us about the work her team is doing on Sawgraph. If you want to learn more about the innovative geospatial work of other professionals, tune into next month's episode. We also want to know what you're working on. So if you enjoyed this episode and have a project that you'd like to share with us on GeoTalks, you can email marketing@bluemarblegeo.com. You can find our show notes, including any resources or data that we mentioned, in the description. If you enjoyed listening, subscribe to our podcast and turn on notifications so you don't miss any episodes.